And thank you very much. Good morning, and time for another edition of Health Essentials. You talk about a gorgeous sunrise this morning. It is spectacular. I almost thought for a moment maybe I saw an angel in the sky, or at least a cloud shaped like an angel. It is so much better to focus your energy on taking care of yourself and putting energy into being proactive, meaning you make good decisions with the food that you eat, you make good decisions about exercise, you try to make sure you get plenty of sleep, you do everything you can to control and regulate your thought life. I mean, because what you think about all day long, that has a big role to play on your health, not just the mental health. All right, I came across this this book. I think I paid $5.99 for it. It's called Home Remedies from a Country Doctor. And I just find this so fascinating. Anyway, I came across a story. I'm going to read it to you. It comes from Brewster Martin, MD, who's a retired family doctor in Chelsea, Vermont. Of course, you want to know what the population is. That's 1,166. He was named the Vermont Doctor of the Year in 1991. That wasn't that long ago, just, you know, 33 years, give or take. Anyway, his little article right here is called The Woman Who Refused a Pen. Okay, and this is Dr. Martin's words. During the 40 years I worked at the Chelsea Family Health Center in Vermont, one of my favorite patients was an elderly woman named Elsie. One day at the age of 96, Elsie had a fall. Her hip still hurt 5 days later, so her daughter called and had me come to see her. I examined her and then took an ambulance and then called an ambulance to take her for an x-ray. It took some persuading to get Elsie to agree to the x-ray. She wasn't one for fancy medical procedures. Sure enough, the test showed that her hip was broken. I told her that the usual procedure at the time was a simple operation that put a pin in the hip. And this is Elsie. I quote, "What did you do before those smart fellows came up with those pins?" she asked. And he said, 12 weeks of bed rest, I told her, followed by some weeks on crutches. And the woman said, "Then I'm going home right now. What's 12 weeks when you lived 96 years?" Having skipped the operation, she was walking around again after a few months. She lived to be 103. He goes on to write that sometimes a good attitude and inner strength are better than the best modern medicine. I couldn't agree more. Of course, I realize that some people, when they hear me read a story like that, they just cringe. They don't like the idea that a person can make their own decisions. Yeah, and that could have gone badly. I realize that. Who would recommend to a 96-year-old just go home and lay in bed for, 12 weeks? There's probably more to it than that. Because what if she developed pneumonia and she suffocated and died? Well, you know what? There's a risk to life. But that is one determined woman. You know, there's a lot of people that have this very, very strong force of will. They decide, they'll say to themselves, okay, I hear exactly what the doctor's telling me. I know what the diagnosis is. I accept that. But I am going to do everything within my power to help myself get better. I'm going to try to get back to good. You know, that is one simple definition of healing. A natural movement back to wholeness. Don't you want to be made whole? Don't you want to get back to good? Don't you want your body in good working order so you can be ready for whatever comes up or what the Lord has in store for you? Do you realize how hard it is once the body is shattered, broken, your health is destroyed? Now, that's a hard one right there. That is really, really difficult to try to help somebody once their health has gone so far down. You know, and some people actually know that. There's other people, though, they're a little bit delusional. They don't really have a good handle on reality. Their body is just completely destroyed, yet they act as if they're all good and there's nothing wrong with them and everything's just fine, so why should they change anything? Well, that's their decision. Why should you suffer just because somebody else makes a decision? Oh, I know what you're going to say. Because I'm the one that has to pick up the pieces and take care of them. Well, you have a good point there. A real good point. So taking care of yourself, that's a way to reduce burdens upon other people. Okay? Now, I'm trying to think of the article I came across this morning. Well, I'm gonna cover this one first, because this comes up so frequently. You would think that I wouldn't have conversations like this with people, but it probably comes up more than you know. So let me kind of lay the foundation here. So you go to bed at 10 o'clock and you wake up at 2:30 every morning. Well, it doesn't take a genius to figure out the math on that one. That's 4.5 hours. That's if you fall asleep easily and quickly. By the way, the phone number here at the station is 903-589-8507. If you call the old number, it's going to go to a different phone line. That's not the one connected to the control board or that goes on the air where I could actually hear your question. The number that you want is 903-589-8507. I just thought I'd mention that since people are already calling the other phone line. Okay, so just very, very simple. If you get less than 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night, you're asking for problems. You just are. And it could be as simple as uncontrolled high blood pressure, or you're taking multiple medications to regulate your blood pressure, and then they put you on a statin, and before you know it, you're taking an acid-blocking pill. And you know what? I keep thinking that people are going to figure out that, you know what, my body's breaking down. I wonder if there's something I could do to help myself. Okay, I was reading an article. I'm trying to think, where did I get this from? I know I've got the name here somewhere. Okay, it comes from the journal Sleep, 2007, December the 30th, 2007. There's one article that says a good night's sleep protects against colds. There's another research article that says sleep speeds up post-viral healing. That shouldn't be rocket science to you. Everybody knows that when you get an illness or a flu or a cold, sleeping is your best friend. Okay? Here's another one called Move More, Sleep More. Meaning it's not good to be sedentary if you want to have good sleep. Anyway, I was looking just briefly at what the researchers... I'm sort of alluding to what they're saying, but number one, I wrote down what that first article said. So here's what we can ascertain. And it has to do with the quality of sleep that a person gets. So the higher the quality of sleep, or if you sleep, 7 to 8 hours, here's what they're saying, that the better you sleep, the more resistant your body is to viruses. Now, that should be pretty easy to understand. If you go too long without sleep, what's going to happen? Your body's going to break down. Your immune system's going to suffer. You're going to be more vulnerable to having the cold or flu. Oh, that's right. The flu's been annihilated from COVID. Now it's just COVID. There's no more flu. Okay, did you know this? It says that the more you sleep within 7 to 8 hours, your body produces naturally more testosterone. And when somebody sleeps 7 to 8 hours as opposed to less than 7, your body builds up your muscle mass faster. Oh, that's a huge deal. If you sleep less than 7 hours, you are absolutely the most likely to put on more body fat. Now, this one was a new one for me, but I like it. It said if you get enough sleep, 8 hours, the more oxygen that your body is capable of absorbing. I find that most interesting. We could probably build a case this morning that oxygen might end up being one of the absolutely most important elements in the universe. You got to have it. They sell these little bitty oxygen pulse oximeters. I think they cost, 17, 18, 20 bucks on Amazon. Other websites also. So they're cheap. But they use that laser diode, and you can very simply put it on your finger, and you can determine the percentage of oxygen, at least at the end of your fingertip. I think it's best if you put on your index finger and you hold your index finger right at heart level. For some reason, I think that always gives me the best readings. Well, what if that number comes back at 94, 95? Well, if your oxygen percentage is 94, 95, you got some work to do. And in this one study, it demonstrates that if you could get 8 hours sleep, this radically improves the amount of oxygen that your body is capable of holding on to and absorbing. Okay? Okay, so here's what happened. Oh, there's one more. It said, if you sleep well, as in 8 hours, you end up living significantly longer compared to people that just sleep 7. And people that sleep 6 hours don't live near as long as people that sleep 7. And if you sleep 5 hours, you live even less. So you have to determine what you have a value for, and if you have a value for the future. Okay, so there was a group of British researchers. What they did was they followed a group of 10,000 British civil servants for 30 years. I would say that's a very interesting observation there. Most of these civil servants were very sedentary, meaning they sat at a desk. They probably did something with a pen and paper. I know that doesn't make sense, but we used to use those. So they tended to have a sedentary lifestyle. And when you're sedentary, I think the studies are showing you might actually need just a little bit less sleep compared to someone that's very athletic and they exercise all the time. Or somebody that has a job where they're out in the pastures walking barefoot through the briars and the brambles. Anyway, the period between, I think it started 1985 to 1988, the researchers measured the amount of sleep the civil servants got each night. Okay? They followed the participants until 2004, which enabled them to complete the table below. You can't see that. This might be just a side note here, but they showed specifically one of their observations that if you were unemployed, all of a sudden you wanted to sleep a lot more than normal. Or if you suffered from horrible depression, you wanted to sleep a lot more than normal. And if you're recovering from cancer or cancer treatments, you sleep more than normal. So I'm not trying to say that more is better. But they're demonstrating that if you sleep 9 hours or more a night, that's actually correlates to living a shorter lifespan. Okay. So for the participants who initially slept 5 to 6 hours a night, I promise you, you know somebody. They may not have told you, but if you asked them, 5 to 6 hours, that's a pretty common length of time for some people to sleep. But my point is that really enough to promote good health? So for the participants in the study who initially slept 5 to 6 hours a night, and then they started to sleep more, the researchers noted that their mortality declined, so the risk of death went down. The researcher makes a note, for the participants who slept 6 to 8 hours a night, and then they started to sleep less, their mortality increased by 60%, and the risk of a fatal heart attack doubled. So if you're sleeping close to 8 hours a night, and all of a sudden you're going to switch to 5, well, you may be another statistic when it comes to a heart attack or dying. Okay, I'm just going to cut through all the jargon here and the tables. At the end of the study, the researchers say, our findings suggest that either a decrease in sleep duration from regular 6, 7, or 8 hours or an increase from a regular 7 or 8 hours predict all-cause mortality, the researchers conclude. So, what I want you to do is I want you to think about this. If you have been to a doctor and they do blood tests or labs and there's something that's out of whack or something's too high or too low, could you at least just take a step back and ask yourself, am I getting the sleep that I need? I think that's a reasonable question. And so one study that I looked at recently showed that we really need right at about 8 hours sleep a night. Really do. Anyway, if you would like to call me on the phone, there is a line open, 903-589-8507. This program is Health Essentials. My name is Roy Morgan. And it is so interesting that there's so many options available to you. And yes, I love the ones that have to do with anything that's natural, that doesn't cause you to have a toxic reaction or to have a reaction to a treatment or a therapy or a drug. Now, this next article right here is really, really interesting. The title of it is A Daily Intake of 5 Dried Plums a Day Halts Bone Loss. This was a very specific trial. And, it's a randomized controlled clinical trial. It's from the journal Osteoporosis International. If you don't know what the word osteoporosis means, it basically means your bones have lost their thickness. They're more porous. They got holes in them. They're porous. You don't want your bones looking like huge holes of Swiss cheese. You want them to be thicker and stronger. For the obvious reasons. I mean, you want to stand up, don't you? Well, you need strong bones to do that. You want to go out and work in the yard? Well, you need strong bones to do that. If you want to have a long, good life on this earth, you need strong bones. How about that? The actual title is not what I said. I kind of gave you my sweet, short version of it. The title is The Effect of 2 Doses of Dried Plum on Bone Density and Bone Biomarkers in Osteopenic Postmenopausal Women. A Randomized Controlled Trial. Anyway, I know that's pretty wordy right there. Okay, in 2016, American researchers published a trial in the journal Osteoporosis International, in which they took 48 women, and the women were somewhere between 65 years of age up to 79. These are the ones that actually participate as test subjects. All the women were in the early stages of osteoporosis, so they were a little bit beyond osteopenia. They actually had osteoporosis. Now, you already know, I don't want anybody to tell me I can't get out of bed without pain because my legs ache and hurt, and my hip bones hurt, and my back hurts. You know, sometimes your bones are just going to hurt for one reason. Well, they're because your bones are weak. And when your bones have holes in them, and you have osteoporosis, and you don't have enough collagen or calcium, or minerals in the bones or protein, your bones are going to do you a favor by aching and hurting. These symptoms are supposed to alert you that your bones might be weak. I can't even tell you how many women that I've talked to over the years that after we get them back on track, all of a sudden their bones just stop hurting. So God has done us a favor here. He's designed the body to warn you when things are not working right. I forgot to give you full disclosure. This study was sponsored by the California Dried Plum Board. So evidently, they provided the prunes for these women. So that's full disclosure, isn't it? But you know what? The test results are the test results. And so the researchers divide the women into 3 groups. For 6 months, one group of women ate 100 grams of dried plums. I did not look up how many plums that is, but it's probably 5. And the second group had 50 grams of dried plums. If I'm guessing, that's about 2.5 prunes. Third group, they didn't have any prunes at all. So when they tested them, both doses of the dried plums stopped the breakdown of total bone mass, and they reduced the concentration of there's an enzyme called tartrate-resistant acid phosphatase 5B. It's called TRAP5B in women's blood. So the higher the concentration of that enzyme, that means your bones are breaking down faster than you can repair them. So you get where I'm coming from. The bones are just my organ system that I'm talking about right now. But any organ system where the cells and tissues break down faster than the ability of your body to keep them in good repair. That's called disease or decay. So here's your takeaway. Women that ate 5 plums a day, they absolutely got completely out of osteoporosis. How hard is that? There's a pretty good chance also that you will not be constipated if you eat 5 prunes a day. Okay, here's another one right here. In 2021, researchers from Penn State University, they published a case study. I don't know what the name of that journal is. I can't read it. It's Bone something. It's my copy. It's my fault. May of 2021. And here's what they did. They followed a 55-year-old woman who consumed 1,200 milligrams of calcium carbonate. I don't recommend that, but that's what they gave her. They also applied 800 international units of vitamin D3, and they gave 50 grams of prunes every day for 16 months. And actually, she did all this on her own anyway, and they followed her. So before she started this cycle, the woman participated in a trial in which postmenopausal women, they received 1,200 milligrams of calcium and 800 IUs of vitamin D3. So scans, this is the important part right here. Scans of the women's skeleton in the study, skeletons, they showed that supplementation with calcium and vitamin D really couldn't do anything on that level to stop the bone loss. I don't know if you get that or not. So if you have a recommendation to take 1,200 milligrams of calcium carbonate and 800 IUs of vitamin D in this study, they could not find any benefit to doing that. Does that make sense? But when they gave prunes, all of a sudden, everything changed. I'm looking at the graphs in the chart. Now, I don't know if you picked up on that, but calcium and vitamin D really didn't do much of anything to stop the bones from becoming more porous or becoming weaker, but prunes absolutely did. Now, I find that interesting. Now, this week, I don't have the study in front of me, but I was watching some research on treating women that had osteoporosis and osteopenia. Have you ever heard of jump training before? Maybe you have been on the website called YouTube, and you've watched some exercise videos because you're curious, and you're trying to come up with, well, what do I do to help myself? And let's just say somebody has a hip problem, a knee problem, a leg problem, lower back problem, and you're thinking, what can I do to regain my strength where my muscles can hold my spine its proper alignment and I can improve my posture? And also on top of that, I'm in so much pain, it would be nice if the pain would just go away. I'd just like my body to heal. Well, it doesn't take a genius to understand that it's the job of your muscles to hold everything in alignment. That's absolutely true and correct. And so doesn't it benefit you to have muscles that do their job properly? They're strong, they're supple, they're flexible, they're not inflamed. How many people do you know of, they can go for a good workout, but they're not sore afterwards? They have a good recovery rate. Probably some, but there's others that you know of. They exercise one time and they're in bed for 4 days because they are so sore and stove up afterwards. Does that make sense? Well, what they did was, all they asked these women to do is, would you try a course of jump training? And jump training can be as simple as both feet are on the ground and there's a very well-built wooden box, usually, in front of the woman. And she's going to basically jump to try to go from the ground level up on top of the box. And I don't know, maybe it's a foot higher. I'm just going to make up a number. I've seen some where it's quite a bit more than a foot, but they're going to have a starting point. Just with jump training alone, these women went from osteoporosis to having strong bones. Well, what does that tell you? I think there's a time and a place where you have to come to where the rubber meets the road, and you've got to put enough stress on your bones and your joints to stimulate protein synthesis. So what are the two things that you need? Number one If you want your muscles to grow, which I promise you you do, if you want to age gracefully, you got to have a decent amount of muscle mass. Physical strength is one of the most important metrics when it comes to a person aging gracefully. Have you ever watched a person try to get out of a car or step over a curb or get up on the sidewalk, or maybe there's a speed bump and they're trying to step over it, or there's an obstacle, or somebody trying to navigate steps or stairs, or maybe more practically, if you just watch people try to rise from a seated position, you can figure out real quick who's struggling and who's not. And of course, all this is so important because you want to be able to have good balance. You're just basically one catastrophic fall away. I think a woman yesterday was telling me she fell backwards. I don't remember the entire story, but she fell backwards. But to try to make sure her head didn't hit the kitchen floor, she stretched her hand out. She broke her wrist, but she spared her head from getting hit, bouncing it off the concrete. And for all I know, that was a good choice. It may not seem that way. But these women that had osteoporosis or bone loss, when they did jump training, that was enough of a adaptive stressor so the body could grow and lay down brand spanking new bone. Isn't that interesting? All without drugs. There were no injections, there was no Fosamax, there was no other drugs, or so many of them. And the thing of it is, all these women were so pleased and happy by the progress they'd made. All right, next article. Now, I went to, let me see, where'd I go? I was reading this article, and I read the term synthetic viruses. And I thought, synthetic viruses, okay. What do you mean a synthetic virus? So I went to Wikipedia and I typed in synthetic viruses, and the terminology that came up was called synthetic virology, okay? And I think you know where I'm going with this. They are talking about, in a laboratory, these are actual man-made viruses. I'm not talking about viruses that occur in nature, like the virus that causes the common cold, or the virus that's linked with influenza or causes influenza or the flu, or polio or smallpox, something like that. So when I was reading about this, oh my goodness, there are so many man-made viruses. They're synthetic. That means they're not natural occurring, and so they can make RNA viruses or DNA viruses. And so then I typed in, what is the purpose of this? I'm trying not to be diabolical, but I'll let you fill in the blanks on your own opinion. The whole purpose of making synthetic viruses, according to this article on Wikipedia, was we're going to make these in order to test different strategies to investigate how we might use and apply and manufacture vaccines. And I thought, okay. You do realize that you have a natural, God-given immune system, don't you? Okay. Well, your immune system, what does it do for a living? Well, it's the system in your body that sets boundaries. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Well, there's certain things that might try to gain access into your body and take over the cells. That'd be like a virus. And it's the job of the immune system to form a boundary to prevent that from happening. Your immune system is supposed to allow the good things to come into you. That might be an avocado or a steak or green beans or a sweet potato or a bowl of blueberries. But it's supposed to keep the bad things out that have the potential to harm you and to damage you. Okay? Isn't it true that every human being, they need boundaries to protect themselves from harm? We could probably make an analogy for like every single area of your life, but at this one, we're talking about viruses. And so as we age, the immune system just doesn't work as efficiently as it used to be. You know what my question is about these synthetic viruses? What if they make a mistake? What if there's a virus that is just so virulent and so potent that it just wreaks havoc and chaos, and it's released, and then we have all these problems because of it? When I say problem, I'm talking about people dying. Anyway, I know this is kind of a morose topic. So here's the article right here. Okay. Oh, what's the title of it? Oh, here it is right here. I realize this is not going to mean much to you, but it comes from April the 5th, 2023. I can't even pronounce the name of the European journal. But anyway, it says, here's the title in English. Vitamin C promotes ACE2 degradation and protects against the SARS-CoV-2 infection. I know that's like really, really wordy right there. So they did a study, and they tried to find out what happens if we have another great exposure, an epidemic of the COVID SARS-2. What if it mutates? Well, what they're doing is they're asking the question, is there anything that we can do to block the virus's attachment to the ACE2 inhibitors or receptor sites? Well, guess what they found out? Researchers from Soochow University in China, they screened vitamins for their ACE2 inhibitory effect. And guess what they came across? Good old vitamin C. I think just about anyone that wants some vitamin C can go and get some. So the coronavirus, you know, the SARS-CoV-2, it enters the human cells through what are called the angiotensin-converting enzyme 2 receptor sites. And they theorize that if you could just halve, cut in half the number of ACE2 receptors, then the SARS or the COVID is going to have the hardest time getting in your cell and actually infecting you. And so, lo and behold, what did they find? They found that vitamin C was absolutely the very best thing since sliced bread helping to prevent all that. And I thought, well, this is easy. Anybody could do this. Anyway, here's what the researchers also did. They wanted to know more. The researchers conducted experiments with mice, and they exposed them not only to vitamin C, but also to synthetic viruses. Okay, that's where I started this topic. They started using man-made synthetic viruses to see if they could attach the spike protein of the COVID SARS to these viruses and thus infect a human being. So, folks, this sounds bizarre to me. So they're making synthetic viruses to see if they can replicate the damage the COVID SARS caused. Anyway, so here's the punchline. Let me try to be positive. If these mice had been adult humans, they would have consumed somewhere between 2 to 3 grams of vitamin C a day. If you don't know what the term gram means, I'll just say 1,000 milligrams, 2 to 3 capsules a day. That should get the job done. So they showed that the vitamin C supplementation reduced the number of your angiotensin-converting enzyme receptors by almost 99%. That's like huge. Do you think it's okay to make synthetic viruses? What happens if they don't protect it? What if they don't protect the technology and it gets out? Anyway, what they're doing is they're trying to find out, what do we do about future viral epidemics? Would you believe me if I told you that as a human being ages, their immune system changes? It usually weakens. You actually have to use a little bit more effort to keep your body in good working order. And that's why I'm telling you this, because this is something that any single person can do. Anybody can go get vitamin C. Hopefully you have enough, you know, money in reserve where you can afford a bottle of it from the health food store. So the older that you are, the greater the protective benefit may be of vitamin C against viral infections. Anyway, I thought that was a very interesting article. All right, if you'd like to join me on the radio, I would be happy to answer any questions that you have. The number here at the station is 903 586. Nope, that's wrong. 903-589-8507. Let me give that number one more time. If you want to call me and ask a question, the number is 903-589-8507. Okay. Here's another one I came across right here. This one is cut from the same cloth. I think I read this one like about 2 weeks ago, but I got it right in front of me, so I'm going to read it to you. In this one, they said half a gram of vitamin C makes your immune system decades younger. And so when I read that, I thought, really? You mean if you just take a little bit of vitamin C, you could go from a 70-year-old immune system and all of a sudden your immune system could function like somebody that's 49 or 50 or 51? Okay. Well, we got somebody trying to call. Let's go to the phone lines. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Dr. Morgan, I think you were in my house last night because I woke up at 2 o'clock. I could not go back to sleep. I started reading, but I was told, and then I did around, I had my clock set for 6:45 so I can be up for your program, and so I went back to sleep a little after 5, got up when my clock went off. But my question is, that happens to a lot of people, and it happens to me from time to time, and I'm wondering why. I had a doctor tell me one time that I was waking up because I was hungry. I told him I didn't feel hungry, but he said I was. And so this morning around, I guess, 4 o'clock or so, I ate me a piece of toasted bread and put some peanut butter on it and ate that with some hot water. But that's my question is, why do we wake up in the middle of the night? I was outside yesterday. I got some sunshine. I didn't walk around, but I sat on my balcony and got some sunshine and stuff.
Oh, that's so good.
Took my shoes off, you know. So I was kind of surprised that I didn't sleep better.
One article that I read probably a year or two ago, it said that as a woman ages, she doesn't break down caffeine the way that she used to. And so what they were saying was, if a woman is used to drinking 2 cups of coffee in the morning, and this is just one example, that would give you a certain amount of caffeine. But as the woman ages, and this is no indication towards you, I'm just telling you the facts, she can't break it down. And if you can't break it down, you can find yourself waking up just wide awake at 2 o'clock in the morning, because you cannot properly detoxify the caffeine.
Okay. Well, I had totally forgotten that I had drank my leftover coffee that I had. I had about, maybe 4 ounces or so left over from my breakfast. And I put ice in it and made me some iced coffee and sipped on that. I didn't drink the whole thing, but I filled a fruit jar up with ice, and so it was pretty weak, but yet it was still caffeine and still coffee. So,
what time did you drink that?
Oh, let me think. Around 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay. Well, let's do that same experiment for the next week, and let's see if you wake up at 2 o'clock. I'm just joking.
I would take it as a joke, even if you weren't.
You mean that your sleep is more important than my jokes and experiments on your body?
I think so.
How much coffee do you normally have of a morning?
At least 2 cups every once in a while. 3.
I'm going to try
Okay.
No, yeah, I did not mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Well, sometimes my cup isn't full, but by the time I have had it all, usually it'll be around 3 cups.
All right. I'm going to try to talk you into a sales pitch here.
Okay.
All right. Do you know what Celtic or Celtic salt is?
Yes, I have Celtic salt.
I'm going to do everything I can to convince you before your lips ever come in contact with your coffee cup, I want you to drink a minimum of 16 ounces of water with just a pinch of Celtic salt added to it before you do anything else in the morning. Now, obviously, yes, you could go to the bathroom, but I want you to make it a priority that the very first thing you do is you attempt to hydrate your body with a little bit of electrolyte minerals in the form of Celtic salt. And let's see if all of a sudden every aspect of the brain begins to work better.
Okay, well now, I've started doing the apple cider vinegar that you told me, I think it was just last week when I called about my fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing that, but before that I was doing soda in my water first thing. So how am I going to work in all these things?
What I'm going to do is put in the same glass of water. I'm going to ask you to put one of those ideas on hold just for the moment to experiment to see how well it goes for you. But I'm going to ask you just for a moment not to do the baking soda, but just do the Celtic salt and the apple cider vinegar in your 16 to 20 ounces of water. And if you'll just commit to drinking that comfortably long before you ever, I would say at least 30 minutes before you have coffee, let's see if we can't rehydrate the brain. I mean, literally, the brain is the very first organ system that becomes dehydrated if you're low in water. So no one's trying to be mean this morning, but coffee is definitely a dehydrator of the body.
Oh, okay.
Now, the next request that I would make, Am I gonna be the mean, evil ogre if I suggest just one cup of coffee in the morning and just stop it?
Well, no, I used to do that, but I've gotten in the habit of just drinking a little more and a little more.
What is the funnest thing that you do every day that gives you the most pleasure and satisfaction?
Well, I guess I do quite a few things. I try to take part in the activities here where I live.
Okay. So that's something to look forward to, right?
That's fun. Yeah, it is.
When do you normally wake up if you've slept well?
Well, I have my clock set for 6:45.
Okay. Well, the sun's starting to come up then.
Mm-hmm.
I notice the days are getting a little bit shorter light-wise. So if you'll do that one thing, if you'll take your 16 ounces of your big glass of water and put a pinch of Celtic salt and maybe a tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, if you would just commit to drinking that before you do anything else, you might stir it a little bit to make it work, but if you'll do that about 30 minutes before your cup of coffee, it may make all the difference in the world.
Okay. Well, I can do that because I get up and drink water first thing right now anyway.
Oh,
so
good.
I can just add the Celtic salt and make sure it's a 16 ounce instead of 8 ounces.
Well, and I realize it's a little bit of a shift, but I think your body's going to really love you for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Anything I can do to keep hydrated, it's going to like me.
And sleep well at night, right?
Right.
Yeah, as far as the coffee goes, I probably would not drink the watered down ice cold coffee after your morning cup.
No, that's just something new that I've started every once in a while. I don't really like it that much.
Well, but you had a little bit left over and you said instead of pouring it out, I'll just put some ice on it and drink it.
Well, actually, what I usually do is I pour it in a fruit jar and put it in the refrigerator, and then the next day I put my leftover coffee in. And then one day I don't have to make coffee because I've got enough in the fruit jar, and I just drink it. Is that okay?
Well,
leftover coffee like that?
I think what I'm suggesting overall is there's going to be a certain level of caffeine that your liver is going to be able to actually break down and detoxify, and if you don't, it's going to remain in circulation, and you're probably not going to sleep very well if you have too much caffeine in your circulation.
But it's okay to drink the leftover coffee one day. I mean, I just drink.
Well,
that
I have a strong opinion about the coffee. I think coffee is literally the most highly sprayed crop of all time. And so when I think about coffee, I think about crop dusters coming down, starting their dive, and then spraying pesticides, insecticides, fungicides, what else? Agent Orange, whatever they spray. So you've got to make sure that your coffee is organic if you're going to drink coffee.
Oh, okay.
Really? Because your body just doesn't need all those toxic chemicals. It doesn't.
Okay. Okay. Organic coffee.
Yeah, just prayerfully consider that. And it may cost a smidgen more, but you're reducing the toxic burden on all your cells. Your cells don't need to swim in an ocean of chemicals.
No, but right now I have two of the large cans of regular coffee. I get it because I like H-E-B coffee, and I live in Tyler, so I go to Carthage and buy my coffee.
You mean they have an H-E-B in Carthage?
They do.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you get there?
I think it's 69. I go through Henderson and on that way. And I have relatives who live there, so I go from time to time, and I just stock up on my coffee, and and I like their peanut butter and, you know, a few items.
How come we don't have an H-E-B in Tyler? Never mind. I think I know the answer.
Yes, you do. Yes.
Sorry. My bad.
Don't get me in trouble.
No, I would never do that. Who, me? Well, thank you very much for your phone call, and I think you've got a little bit of room for improvement there. So let's try this in an experiment and see how it works out for you, okay?
Okay, I will do it. Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am.
You have a good day.
You too. Thanks for your phone call.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. All right. Bye-bye.
Boy, she's so sweet, isn't she? All right, if you'd like to join me on the radio, there's a phone line open, 903-589-8507. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good morning. How you doing, Doc?
I'm doing great, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing good. Got a question for you. I'm 63. Last year, I had some stents put in my heart, and they got me on Plaxid. They said that I have to take that from now on to keep the plaque from building up and trying to stop those stents up.
It's called Plavix, right?
What's your thoughts on Plavix, yes, sir. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, there's an article that I read the other day, and it was from 1994 or 1995. I just lied to you. 95 to 96, somewhere around there. Middle 90s, how about that? And they asked the question, they said, and this is not exactly your question, but let me kind of start off with this, and we'll try to flesh it out. But they asked the question, if somebody takes a statin drug to lower cholesterol, does that have any bearing on future plaque formation? So another way of saying it is, if you take a statin drug that's touted to reduce plaque, does it actually do that? Is that a fair question?
Right, yes.
So the answer of the study was no. Taking a statin drug does not do anything whatsoever to reduce plaque formation. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to answer the question differently, because I read another article this week, and I meant to take a picture of it because I saw it on the computer and I didn't do it. But I'm going to go back and see if I can look it up. But now in medicine, they're looking at a very unique biomarker, and a biomarker is just taking the existing lab test and kind of playing with the ratios and seeing if they can figure out if a person's at a risk for having plaque formation in the arteries. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you three or four different ideas. But there's a very, very simple blood test called a lipid profile or lipid panel.
Okay.
And in that test, they usually will measure total cholesterol. They're going to measure triglycerides. They measure a lipoprotein known as HDL. Sometimes we call it high-density lipoprotein. And then the one that they call bad cholesterol, they call that LDL. But there's one more that I think is worth taking a look at. It's called VLDL. Now, as a general rule, this is just a general idea. When, according to Linus Pauling and Dr. Mathai, they say that when they notice in the laboratory that the VLDL starts going above the number 21, that is when plaque begins to form in the arteries at a greater rate than what your body can reabsorb it. Okay? I'm still coming back to your question, okay?
All right.
The other marker that I mentioned earlier, called HDL, H as in Harry, it just stands for high density lipoprotein. They've noticed that when that number starts hitting about 60, then you're removing plaque buildup from the arteries, so that it actually is very cardioprotective. It protects your arteries against plaque formation. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so here's what they're doing. They will take a man's triglyceride levels, so you can go back and look at your labs, because I guarantee you they've done all sorts of labs on you if they put you on stents and Plavix.
Right.
Okay, so you can take your triglycerides, and what you do is, and I'm just going to make up a number here. Let's say that your triglyceride level is right at the number 80. That's not technically horrible. And let's say your HDL is 40, even though I just told you that 60 is kind of the target range where you want to be, and you can accomplish that. Sometimes physical training and exercise will increase the HDL. But anyway, if I take 80 and divide that by 40, then I come up with a number 2, right?
Right.
And so this is called a biomarker or a biometric. When your ratio of triglycerides divided by HDL is 1.6 or higher, that's when you're going to be most prone to your arteries clogging back up again. It means that your cardiovascular system is not very fit.
Okay.
All right. The one that I really want, if I could do a test on you, it's a very simple one. It's called fasting insulin. And I know this is like a tremendous oversimplification the way I'm saying it, but when you do a fasting insulin test, it is going to tell me so much about the condition of your arteries. And all I'm suggesting is, as a man ages, everything begins to change. And so we're looking at what can we do to help ourselves to prevent this from taking place. But you're probably like me. You're probably thinking, do I really have to take this drug the rest of my life to prevent, you know, that stent from getting clogged up? Well, what I'm wanting to do is I want your arteries and your blood vessels to be so healthy that you don't have to have that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I know tons of people that have been able to completely get off the Plavix with their doctor's blessing because they were in good working order. They just didn't need it. Even the cardiologist took them off of it. So, what exactly is your top question for me?
I guess it would be, what kind of natural remedies I could to get that levels down like you're talking about, and is taking this medicine here long term, is there some bad side effects to it?
Oh yeah, there's lots of side effects to it. What I'm gonna do is I'm gonna try to cover the first question first. There's a flavonoid, and you're gonna find it in apple peels, or the skins of an apple is found in the skins of onions. But then again, I've always liked onions and apples. How about you?
Absolutely.
Okay, so there's a flavonoid compound. It begins with the letter Q. It's called quercetin. That's the way I pronounce it. I've heard some people pronounce it quercetin. That's okay, too. I don't mind. But there's an analog, which means the biggest part of quercetin is a flavonoid called rutin. R-U-T-I-N. Now, I had a very famous professor send me a text from Tyler the other day. Her name is Dr. Judith Von Hamm. You probably have heard of her.
Yeah,
sorry, that might be an inside joke on my part. I think I'm funny sometimes when I'm not. But she sent me this text saying that the number 4 selling item from Whole Foods last year, from the bulk, was a substance called buckwheat. Have you ever heard of buckwheat?
Yes.
I'm not talking about the little rascals buckwheat. I'm talking about the like if you were to get some buckwheat pancakes or something.
Right, I got you.
But buckwheat is absolutely the greatest source of all time of rutin. And the reason I'm bringing that up is, if you wanted to find the most perfect substance that has ever been studied in the universe to keep your blood from clotting, it's rutin.
Okay.
I mean, I don't have the studies directly in front of me. I have a book of research at my office that I look at frequently, and those articles say this is absolutely the greatest thing since sliced bread when it comes to keeping your blood from clotting. And I guess here's the road I'm going down right here. If you ask me what is it that costs the most healthcare dollars of all time, I would say it would be anything related to a clot that would form in the brain that could cause a stroke. Or if you had a clot in the lung that causes a pulmonary embolism, that's bad. Or if somebody had a clot that formed in the artery of the heart, that's called a heart attack. Or if somebody had a clot formed in their calf muscle, it's called a deep venous thrombosis. So if I added up the medical cost of treating all those, that would be the vast majority of all the money just treating what I'm going to call cardiovascular disease. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So what I want you to do is I want you to look up that substance called buckwheat, because the flavonoid compound you're looking for is called rutin. And to the best of my knowledge, I've looked at the studies. Doesn't mean I haven't missed one. I mean, I can't read them all. But rutin doesn't do anything to put you at risk of your blood becoming too thick or too thin, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Can I tell you a real quick story?
Sure.
Okay, I'm thinking, did this happen 3 weeks ago? Okay, I'm going to say 3 weeks. I had this man, and he said, Dr. Morgan, he said, I am embarrassed when I go to church. And I said, why is that? He says, because I have to wear the longest sleeve shirts of all time. And I said, how come? And he rolled up his sleeves and he showed me. His arms look like purple, bloody bruises and where it's been bleeding under the skin all up and down his arms.
Right. I get that from time to time.
Yeah, but also besides you, haven't you been out in public before or been to church or a restaurant and you've seen the skin of somebody's arms or legs? It looks like somebody beat him with a stick.
Oh, yeah.
Those are all just blood vessels breaking. Well, anyway, here's what happened. When he came back to me, he said, I want to show you something. I said, what is it? He said, look at my arms. I said, oh, my goodness. They were like almost perfect. There was no bloody blisters or bruises anywhere. And guess what we used? We used buckwheat. Isn't that something? So I think, and I'm really telling you spot on the truth on this deal, because it's almost like borderline unbelievable the body could heal that fast. But you know what? It's okay with me if I'm just literally amazed at every turn at how quick the body can heal when you just give it the right circumstances, right?
Right. Would you suggest taking the rutin as a supplement and the
buckwheat? Yeah, yeah. Well, the rutin is probably the simplest thing that you could do as a supplement. And so most studies show somewhere between 500 milligrams to maybe 1,000 milligrams is really a reasonable dose. But as far as I know, I have not seen any negative side effects of a person taking rutin if they're taking an agent or a drug of some kind. But, I mean, you might want to look it up yourself. And if you have a computer, you can just type in, can I take rutin with Plavix?
Right.
But, yeah, I think that's a reasonable goal to try to get your blood back to where it's not so thin and not leaking all the time. I don't want your blood vessels breaking apart.
Right. So would you continue to take the Plavix while you're taking this rutin supplement?
Well, here's my next thought, and I know I'm not directly answering your question because I need to say this first. To the best of my knowledge, the most accurate blood test that you can have run on your blood is called D-dimer. So if you were to spell that, it would be like just the letter D, D as in dog or David, and then a dash, and then you spell the word dimer. It's like the word dime with an R on the end of it.
Okay.
And so if they run a D-dimer test, that's probably going to tell you one way or the other whether you need to change the dose of the Plavix or not. So I'm not trying to pretend I'm the cardiologist doing their job for them. But you might want to look at that, a D-dimer test, just to kind of find out for yourself. I think it's really good for a man to be very curious about his health and find out how he wants to improve himself like you. But I am a huge fan of eating stuff like salmon and ocean fish. I think that's so good for your blood.
Right.
Beets are really good for the blood. They're almost the color of the blood. Unfortunately, we are completely out of time, or I would try to do a little bit more for you. So, but I've given you some things to think about, haven't I?
Absolutely.
All
great
right.
Show, Doc.
You betcha.
Good work, buddy.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. Thanks for listening to the radio.
You bet, bye.
All right, have a good day, bye. All right, you're listening to KBGS FM 90.3, Jacksonville, Tyler, and Longview.